Brother Donald Holliday hails from West Wickham, England. This evening he will favor us with a discourse entitled, How to Walk on Water. How to Walk on Water. Brother Holliday.
We bring you a lot of love from the brethren back in England. In fact, it only seems hours ago, it was only hours ago, that we left the shores of England, arriving on Thursday evening. And right now it's something like just after 3 a.m. in England. So I hope you'll bear up with me, brethren, because that's what my time clock is telling me that it is. And strangely, it's at this very time of the early hours of morning that our story begins today. How to walk on water. Sometime after 3 a.m. in the fourth watch of the night, most normal people are in bed. But the disciples of Jesus are in a little boat on the Sea of Galilee. And they are far from asleep. Their boat is being tossed by the boisterous waves, whipped up against them by a strong and contrary wind. This wasn't a particularly unusual experience. They were fishermen, they were used to the rapidly changing moods of that sea. Although there seems to have been perhaps something rather personal about this adverse gale, certainly this was going to be a night that they would never forget. They've had a most remarkable day. Thousands have come out to the public witness meeting. So far as they could count the multitude, there were about 5,000 men. And to this great number was added the women and the children beyond their ability to count. There must have been over 10,000 people there. And they'd all come out of the towns and the villages to hear the truth, and to hear Jesus. It must have been a most moving scene, and the disciples must have felt greatly honored to be in any way involved with such a wonderful teacher. The crowds hung on the words that came from those gracious lips of the Master. His teachings and his manner of teaching was so different from anything else I'd ever heard. There was a challenge in his words that seemed to enter deep into the heart and search those unseen inward parts. Now every one of those hearers would have his own concept of the kingdom and the kingdom hope and the special part that Israel was to play in that kingdom arrangement. And mostly these concepts would be very natural, even carnal notions appealing to human pride. Were they not the people of God? But the kingdom that Jesus proclaimed, this was something else. This was deep. This was so beautiful. The Lord enthroned in every heart, and that most hallowed presence dismissing pride and every sinful thought, until the power of holiness beautified each sanctuary. We don't know what particular truths were there imparted to that throng. They were so hungry for his words that they forgot their own natural body's needs. We only know that it must have been a most compelling theme that so held their attention. This was no 40-minute talk, brethren. The disciples, of course, had become aware of the practicalities. They were getting a bit uneasy now at such a vast crowd. The lateness of the hour, they were noticing the going down of the sun. They had yet to find their way home, this great multitude, before they could have their next meal. And they interrupted Jesus with a whisper, "Shouldn't he be stopping now? Shouldn't he be sending the multitudes away?" We know this account so well, brethren. We've read it over and over again. But for them, this was first time. This was first hand. This was a wonderful, new and vivid experience that their minds would tingle over on every future recollection. We know what happened. They became the instruments in the demonstration of a power way beyond anything known to man. 5 loaves, 2 little fishes, just enough supper for 1 young lad. And yet everyone in that vast throng went home full, while each of the 12 disciples filled their baskets with the leftovers. You know, we read these accounts, brethren, but do ever we feel that we were really there? Tomorrow's lunch is 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and we're only a very small section of 10,000. Well, what a wonderful climax to a wonderful day. One day perhaps they'd reflect on that scene and realize that they had witnessed a glowing portrayal of that blessed day to come when all human need, both physical and spiritual, would be divinely satisfied. And they would again be the instruments used of the Lord to convey these blessings to mankind. Just as those disciples went out amongst those crowds offering them bread, and the people's hands were coming out to receive the bread. What a wonderful illustration that was, brother. These dear disciples were learning to live with the mighty power of God. And this is an essential part of the preparation of each one of those future ministers of that kingdom. Each one is a vessel of divine grace, a channel of divine love, an instrument through which the Lord would exhibit the glory of his power to give life, life abundant, to as many as who would open out their hearts, reach out their hands to receive it. And then at last the crowds dispersed and Jesus was left with his disciples, but not before another wonderful moment which doubtless brought them each great joy, because the crowd was so elated by this experience. They started gathering in excited groups together and rallying together support, very eager, very ready support. And the disciples suddenly realized what was up. They were going to descend upon Jesus, all these thousands, and demand that he become their king. What a wonderful moment was this, the kingdom coming. Who better than he could deliver them from all their enemies? But before they could approach him, Jesus graciously motioned them away. And he left the scene, climbing higher up that mountain trail to be alone with his Father. Jesus knew what this all foreshadowed. And doubtless it was to the Master a deeply moving, a deeply emotional experience. How he longed for that future time, that day when men would deeply and faithfully respond to divine love in a way more enduring than the excitement of that crowd. He'd bid the disciples to get into the boat and to go ahead of him to Bethsaida, the house of fishing, leaving him alone with his Father in prayer in the peace of that higher plane. And the day ended with the disciples in the midst of the sea, and Jesus gone up on high to be with the Father. It doesn't take very much imagination, does it, brethren, to realize here a whole gospel age depicted in that night of weary toil for the disciples of Jesus representing the church. He had left them. He had gone to the Father. They were struggling now. toiling. It was such hard going for the disciples because a storm had risen and a contrary gale. Everything seemed against them. And adversity could hardly be more forcefully demonstrated than in this way. They were straining at the oars, but those struggles seemed to avail nothing. They were getting nowhere. That wonderful time of the Master's presence now seemed so long ago and so far away. Hour after hour they toiled. The journey taking so much longer than they had anticipated, it was taking an age. And how they longed for the sight of the dawn and for the welcome shore. But Jesus knew. The accounts tell us that from his vantage point on high, he could see what was happening in the sea. He could see them in the midst of that storm. He knew their needs. And yet one by one the watches of the night came and passed. And it was in the fourth watch of the night, sometime after 3 a.m., that the disciples glimpsed in the midst of that troubled sea a sight so amazing that they feared. It was the presence of Jesus, a sight that we might think would have brought them great cheer. And yet, a sight so amazing, it troubled them because this was a Jesus that they were yet to know. He was indeed the same Jesus, but now demonstrating the ability and the powers associated more with the divine than with the human plane. So what a scene indeed, dear brethren. The stormy winds and the boisterous waves that rose high to threaten that tiny ship. And yet there they saw Jesus walking on that troubled water as though it was solid rock. The fear of the disciples was because they glimpsed a being with powers of another world. They saw him as a being not of human flesh, but of spirit. And the glimpse of spirit realms brought them the greatest awe. The implication for our days are no less awing to our hearts, brethren. Blessed indeed are the eyes that see beyond the power of human natural sight the glory of the spirit realm. And of that one who now stands here amidst the earthly scene, whom earth knows not. We often used to sing the hymn as children, how I would have loved to have been with him then. And I wonder, would we have loved to have been with the disciples in Galilee in this situation, brethren, and in this scene? We couldn't all be there to share that scene firsthand, to feel the might of those battering waves and the force of that gale, the darkness that was surrounding all. But someone else was there to act as a kind of proxy for us. And we all know who that proxy was, don't we, brethren? Peter. Dear Peter. How we loved Peter. So often did that earnest heart of Peter prompt some action or response to a situation that we know was overall for us. We each can say for me. Because in Peter, we see ourselves. It's so easy to read these accounts and just take Peter's name out and put our name in. Because each of these conversations, each of these interactions between Jesus and Peter are so meaningful to us, brethren. In this particular scene, it must be true to say not only saints at this end of the age, when that blessed presence is glimpsed of a glorious returned Lord, but there's a lesson here for saints all down the age that each one of them must have enjoyed. But now, it must belong to us, brethren, because we are those that are alive and remain in this day. But the dispensational message we cannot miss. For when Jesus and the disciples were united together, when he joins them in the boat, the storm at once abates, and the wind drops, and the sea becomes a great calm. And John tells us in his account of this scene that immediately they were at the other shore. Now we cannot expect an end to the time of trouble, nor an end to the period of testing and tribulation for the saints, until the last is gathered to be forever with the Lord and that union is complete. That's the dispensational message. But there's also, of course, a very personal message for each saint here, pertaining to the whole of his walk this side of the veil. It is applied throughout the age, but it has now this special meaning for each one of us today, in this time of the Master's presence, in the very midst of earth's troubled scenes. Peter was reassured by the Master's voice, calling out in the midst of that storm, "Take courage, it's me, don't be afraid." What comfort we find too in recognition of the one who stands before us now today, endowed with such wondrous powers. The earth hears and trembles, but Zion hears and is glad. In the midst of so much that would disturb the mind, so many acts that demonstrate the influence of powers of darkness, and all human existence on this earth is threatened by a flood unrivaled since the days of Noah. What comfort to our hearts, brethren, to hear the voice of our beloved saying, "Don't be afraid, it's me." But Peter was so stirred. He could see now that Jesus had powers that overcame all limitations to the flesh. And he glimpsed reality beyond all natural sight. He caught sight of another realm. A blessed truth now stared him in the face. And Peter, dear impulsive Peter, wanted for himself to taste that power divine. Was that wrong of Peter? We think not, brethren. We feel convinced that here is a wondrous situation created by the Lord to teach us all what Peter sought to learn, how to walk on water. When Jesus walked upon the sea, he demonstrated a walk with no visible means of support. What kept him up? We don't have any problems with that question, brethren. We know that he was sustained and upheld by an invisible power greater than any power of earth. Jesus knew how to walk on water, how to walk depending upon no visible means of support. Here was faith in its fullness. It is called faithfulness. That is faith to the uttermost. Faith that controls the life, the mind, the state of inward rest. A faith that finds a rock beneath the feet when there's nothing to see. Faith that becomes a walk and a way of life. And Peter spoke for each one of us when he said, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you on the water." But how right that we should not presume, but meekly ask, "Lord, if it's your will, the word must come from him. Come, follow me." This is no license to put God to the test by foolishly demanding his overriding of our neglect to take due care or to make provision where it lies within us for our earth. Now, during the last great war, the question rose amongst the friends in England as to whether we should use the air raid shelters that everyone went into night after night as the bombing raids took place. Should we use the shelters like the neighbours, the people in the world? It's true that we didn't hear of any of the Lord's people, that we heard of anyway, being harmed during all that 6 years of bombing. Save one case. And strangely, that one case concerned some friends who left their former home in the Midlands, in a very dangerous kind of area, to find a home as far away from Europe as they could, on the west coast and far to the north. And that very same family were the only ones known to me to be harmed by bombing. The house was turned to rubble, and the daughter was buried underneath the rubble. And she lives today, minus a few digits from one hand. Meanwhile, the hometown Coventry was razed to the ground by fire and bombing, and we watched the sight of that burning, like that of Sodom, a great fire in the skyline from 20 miles away. Another air raid destroyed a home of brethren in the south, but they were sheltering. No one was hurt. And the sister involved has recounted how on her return to what had been her home, she entered the hallway to notice one picture still hanging on the wall. That of Brother Russell. Some things can be shaken, and some things remain. The Lord may well allow us to suffer for our foolishness if we fail to use the shelter provided, fail to use the strength that he gives to earn our living, fail to watch in crossing the road, or to take reasonable care to secure our few possessions. But what Peter was asking had nothing to do with such wild concepts of the providential overruling of God. Peter was asking that the Master's power to overcome the evil powers of this world, to resist that downward force that ever tends to gravitate the mind to earth, to be upheld by those great invisible powers of divine source, that these the Master should share with him. Peter wanted to experience in himself the greatness of that power of God. Now, Peter may not have sat down and worked all this out and carefully analysed exactly what was in his request. We don't think that, brethren, but we strongly feel that while some blind impulse prompted his request, he hadn't learned yet that long-sighted vision that he speaks of in his later epistle, that the Spirit would endow, which sees beyond the limits of the immediate, the present, a heavenly purpose working out on a grand scale that we're privileged to co-work with. But we believe that the Lord, who knows our thoughts and our words ahead of us, that he makes good use of that foreknowing to his own wise end. The Lord had arranged all this, hadn't he, brethren? Not only for Peter, but for you and me. And so we believe that in Peter's request and in the Master's invitation, in response to that request, we're encouraged to look beyond the workings of the natural mind of that moment, to the deeper lesson that the whole situation was designed to illustrate so vividly for you and for me. First, we must ask the Lord's enabling power implied in his command that we should follow closely in his steps. The Lord will never ask us to do the impossible. And yet it is equally true to say that what the Lord invites us to do is impossible. And yet I'm sure that everyone here knows the truth that will reconcile these two apparently quite contradictory statements, that the things that are impossible with men are not impossible to God. We are called to walk in the steps of Jesus, God's holy Lamb. Where do we begin to do that, brethren? You remember those planes on the chart, the plane of human perfection? And some were down here, that's where we were, brethren. Corrupt, fallen man. How do we begin to walk on that plane? Against every quality of the Master, we may put a true description of ourselves. Holy, corrupt, blameless, guilty. Jesus never needed to ask forgiveness. Never. I'm asking forgiveness all day long. And sometimes I ask him to forgive me for asking him to forgive me so often in the course of one day. But how can we begin to stand where Jesus stood, brethren, to take those steps that Jesus took to walk as Jesus? The very first thing that Peter had to do was to believe that if Jesus gave the word, he had the power. Believe. Sounds so simple, doesn't it, brethren? Only believe. Step out of the rocking boat into the boisterous waves of the sea, knowing that the power is there. How different that picture is, brethren, to the thought of believing while we're sitting comfortably in convention or at meeting or in our homes, with our friends, with health, our loved ones, good strength and so on. Oh yes, brethren, this is the Bible concept of believing. It means to put all our confidence, all our trust on something that is truly worthy of it, to rely upon it, to lean upon it, and to stand on it, to accept as the total means of support. Jesus knew how to walk on water. He knew how to walk with no visible means of support. And of course the word visible here refers to all the natural things that can be seen by man, on which he often places confidence or trust. Our job, our home, our health, our family, our friends, position in life, income, pension, all our material possessions. Whatever we may have of these, brethren, we're very grateful for them. We thank the Lord for the ship that we're in. There's nothing wrong about good health, about having a home, about having friends. What would be contrary to our walk with Jesus would be to depend upon any one of these things for our sense of well-being or of peace of mind. How easy it is to say that, brethren. The believing illustrated by Peter meant stepping out of that boat. Shaky as it was as a basis of confidence, even a rocky boat is a visible means of support. And each one of the things that we mentioned are like that rocky boat, somewhat uncertain, be it health or job or the like. But what a test of real faith is involved in stepping out of that boat. Surely it means putting ourselves at the mercy of the waves. It has to be suicide. Oh no. What it really means is abandoning the things that can be shaken, that rocky boat, and placing our feet upon a rock. But no one can see that rock. No, it is invisible. And that is where faith is so vital to walking with Jesus. How do we know that it is faith that enables such a walk? We have the evidence in what happened next to Peter. To read the account in Matthew 14 verse 30 is to recognize a situation that we all know oh so well. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried, saying, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him and said to him, O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt? I wonder if there's anyone here who has not already been through this very experience, brethren. Faith is the evidence. Faith is the evidence, the only evidence, that there is something there. Something more real, more solid, more certain, more secure than any outward object seen. No one can see what the child of faith is standing on, what supports him, what upholds him through tribulation, enables him in weakness. All that can be seen is the faith and the effect of that faith. Yes, the visible aspects of total trust, peace, confidence, even joy, at times and in situations where the world would expect dismay and fear and utter dejection, expect us to sink. Knowing how to walk on water is the same secret as the opening of that gate to the narrow way, of which Jesus said, "Few there be that find it." It's like that window of the heart that opens up to heaven itself when this body of death is locked in the stocks of the innermost pit of the prison. And that prison takes many forms in the lives of the Lord's people. But the visible evidences of faith, the attitude of prayer and praise, are the evidences of the unseen rock. In whatever way the flesh may be confined, restricted, imprisoned, only to quicken the more that spirit of perception that enjoys the glorious liberty of sons of God. Peter was just the first one to step out of that boat and to take to himself the power, the upholding power of the Lord, to walk with no visible means of support. Down through the age, all the Lord's people have had to learn to do this, to leave the boat, to step out of the boat, to trust totally in the Lord. Paul stepped out of the boat. He had learned how to walk on water. Bonds and afflictions, yes, he knew that they were waiting for him. Do we know anything about apprehension, brethren? That fear of what lies just ahead, or what may lie ahead. Sometimes imagination helps it on, doesn't it, brethren? And we imagine all kinds of trials and difficulties that seem to be looming up before us. How easy it is to be apprehensive of the pain, of the trial, of the affliction, and not be apprehensive of the grace. He giveth more grace when the burdens are greatest. Why are we here, brethren, if not to explore the grace? Before our course is finished, this vessel of grace has got to be full and pressed down and flowing over with experience and dependence upon the grace of God. Bonds and afflictions wait for me, but none of these things move me. Neither count I my life, this present earthly existence, dear unto me. Do we, brethren? How would we value our present earthly existence? What would we do to hang on to it a bit longer? While we look not at the things that are seen, but the things which are unseen. Yes, Paul had learned the secret of walking on water. No one will be an overcomer who does not step out of the boat and learn how to walk with Jesus, with no visible means of support, but with the glories of those things that are eternal, so central to the vision, so real, so dear, and so intimately nigh. It must have been a frightening moment when poor Peter found himself sinking into those waves. You know, I feel guilty about it. I feel that the Lord had arranged Peter to have that experience, especially for me, because the lesson is there for me. We wouldn't wish it on him, brethren. Wouldn't wish it on anyone. But how often the Lord uses our failures to teach those lessons which we otherwise never so deeply and so permanently learn. We all know from personal experience what it means to find ourselves looking at the boisterous wind and waves, those dark, threatening and very visible contradictions to our faith. We all know what that means, brethren. Every step of that walking on water is a test of faith. Faith has to become and remain ever live, ever real, ever active. Many of you dear ones I see are like me now retired. But there's no retirement from the life of faith, brethren. We need it even more as the years advance. Now we love the thought that as with Enoch of old, this walk of faith with the Lord becomes so real, so totally absorbing to the mind, that we become translated. Do not see death. See only that glorious, victorious Lord standing at the right hand of the throne of God, victor, and hear that one word ringing in our ears, come. Overcome. This is a victory, even your faith. That love of Jesus compels and makes that word a command when he says come. Because Jesus expressed his love and total trust in God when every visible sign of divine favor was removed. At Golgotha, all visible evidence cried out that he had been abandoned to the power of darkness. And yet was he, our blessed Master, faithful unto death. Do I need visible evidence of my Father's love and care? How far has faith progressed since first I believed? See, faith is an understanding that we have with the Lord. It depends on nothing other than his abiding faithfulness. We don't need to see those many hands outstretched to aid us on the way. We know, faith knows, that he is there and that he is for us and knows every detail of the process required to bring me to himself in that bond of perfect trust. Peter stepped out of that boat. When he did that, he needed something more real than all those earthly things that contradicted the stand that he was about to take. Something more real than those waves and that wind. More dependable than the rocking ship made with human hands. He needed the most dependable power that exists. And to reach for it, he needed totally genuine faith. Faith that can let go. And faith that can take hold. You know, every account of this wonderful incident is very interesting. We've got it in Matthew 14, Mark 6 and John 6, and each adds some precious, meaningful detail. And we read in the account in Mark, chapter 6, verse 48, that as the vision appeared of this wonderful Master and Lord walking upon those waves, he made as though he would pass them by, proceeding in his walk towards the further shore. Perhaps it was this realization that spurred Peter on to make that request, the Lord's command to follow him. Peter didn't want the Lord to pass him by. He wanted to be with his Lord, walking there on the boisterous sea. And dear brethren, we don't want the Lord to pass us by. We don't want to follow him far off from the uncertain safety of a storm-dashed ship. We're not armchair saints. The privileges afforded to us at this hour must not pass us by. It is your faith that is now on trial. This is the hour, not later, but now, to realize the power of total trust and of faith in his uttermost expression. Nor do we need to wait for that hour of tribulation when we may be faced with the breaking on the rocks of that ship that we had trusted for our security and our peace of mind. if indeed that moment comes when life's illusions are shattered all around us and swept away by some disaster, we may take courage from the message of those precious accounts of the disciples and Jesus on that troubled sea. Our terror will only be calm when we recognize that voice of our Master and Lord calling through the storm, "Don't be afraid, it's me, it's Jesus." But brethren, we don't need to wait for such a shake-up of our misplaced confidence and trust. The truth is tearing at us now, today, if we will hear his voice, who walks that walk of challenge and defiance to the things that may be seen by the natural sight. So many things are seen to contradict the walking on water, the walk of true faith. There's nothing unreal about these contradictions. They are very real. This body of humiliation, that's very real. How it humiliates those pure desires for a life of total holiness. How it contradicts those high aspirations of the new mind. How we long for that, dear brethren. For that state where every thought of mind, every attitude and motive of our hearts will be pure and holy and pleasing to our Father and to our Lord, and where we shall not need each day to say, "Lord, I'm sorry." How we long for that blessed state, brethren. The vessel is of clay, that the excellency of the power might be seen to be of God. One after another, the things on which man's sense of well-being depends may be taken from us. It happens to everyone around us, not just the Lord's people. It happens to the world too. Health and strength and partner and friends, all these things have a coded date stamp beyond which corruption may set in or loss. We don't know the code. We don't know when it will be. It can be any moment. So how vital to our peace, that peace which surpasses humanity's limited understanding, that we learn to walk on water now, before that evil day, and then shall we say in the triumph of well-tried personal experience of the Lord's enabling power, "Let the chill mists gather round me, let the lights of earth grow dim, leave me Jesus, only Jesus, I'm satisfied with him." May the Lord help each one of us to walk on water. And may this little nightmare that I have, once I chose this theme, that I keep seeing these headlines in the newspaper, hundreds drown after a Bible students' exhibition, convention, may it never be.
Thank you, Brother Holliday.
Heavenly Father, in the precious name of Jesus, we have such boldness in entering into thy presence that we would not have without. And we thank thee, Father, for the realization of so great a love surrounding each one of thy children. We pray for each one now, Father. Thou knowest exactly what thou art about in the processes and all that must take place in their experiences, in their circumstances and situations of their lives, to bring them to that state that thou canst use them for that future blessing of all the families of the earth. We know, dear Father, that thou dost require our total trust and confidence in thee, come what may. And we can only ask that thou wilt increase our faith, and that thou wilt enable us, dear Father, to do those things which are totally impossible without thee. Without me, ye can do nothing. But we thank you, dear Father, that we have that enormity of thy power at work in our lives and in our hearts. We pray now, dear Father, that all the words that have been spoken this day may indeed be received as seed in good and honest ground, and may this word richly dwell within each one of us, Father, and bring forth a fruitage to thy praise. And we ask now that as thou dost take note of our responses, the responses of each heart bow before thee now, that thou wilt note that incense of praise that ascends to thee, and which we now wish to manifest in songs of praise to thee, Father.